The Free Library of Philadelphia is proud to present a podcast from our award-winning author events series, recorded live at the Parkway Central Library on the Benjamin Franklin Parkway. To learn more about the Free Library, our unique and inspiring collections, and how your contribution can help our programs and services for the community, please visit freelibrary.org.
Good evening, everyone. My name is Laura Kovacs, and I'm honored to introduce our guests this evening. Ilian Wu is the author of The Great Divorce, a 19th century mother's extraordinary fight against her husband, the Shakers, and her times, and the recipient of a Whiting Creative Nonfiction Writing Grant and fellowships from the American Antiquarian Society and the National Endowment for the Humanities. She joins us with her new work, Master, Slave, Husband, Wife, An Epic Journey from Slavery to Freedom. A New York Times review calls the book a suspenseful, sensitively rendered account. This evening, she will be joined in conversation with Imani Perry, recipient of the 2022 National Book Award for Nonfiction for South to America, A Journey Below the Mason-Dixon to Understand the Soul of a Nation. Please join me in welcoming Ilian Wu and Imani Perry to the Free Library.
Good evening, everyone. I am so delighted to be here in conversation with my friend of many years. Yeah. We're not until we first met in second grade. And here we are. And it's such a delight to talk about this truly extraordinary, gorgeous, brilliantly researched, brilliantly written book. Just so deeply moving and so important. And so I guess the first question I wanted to ask you, which I think is an opening for all of you who may or may not know the story of the crafts, although if you have not yet read this book, it's not likely that you have a sense of the full breadth and depth of their stories. Why? Why the crafts? Like, what drew you to this story in particular?
Well, thank you. Thank you, Imani, my friend of second grade. Thank you, everybody who's here, and thank you to the library for having us today. Why the crafts? What brought me? The crafts brought me into their story. Yeah. The crafts' own writing, their 1860 narrative, Running 1,000 Miles for Freedom. I was assigned that text in a graduate seminar. And it's one of those reading experiences that you just don't forget. Yeah. Or I remember where I was and where we were speaking about this earlier. Sometimes you read a text that feels like it's being whispered in your ear, something that feels heard. Your own writing feels like that to me, Imani. Thank you. And that's the kind of experience I had with that book, and I felt pulled in. And they tell this incredible story. You know, I mean, it's full of adventure and plot twists. The crafts, you know, disguise themselves as master and slave when they're actually husband and wife. Mm-hmm. And they tell this amazing love story and this adventure by which they escape, with Ellen disguised as this master and William posing as her slave. So there was, of course, that page turner. And there was so much they told along that journey, but there was also, there were questions. There were things that they could not or that they would not tell. Mm-hmm. And those were the parts of the story, I think, that kept calling me back over the years.
Mm-hmm. Can you say a little bit more, just for folks who don't know that, like, what would you say are the sort of, without giving away too much, because it really is a page, your work is a page turner, but like the sort of signposts of their life, or the sort of the story behind the story, as it were. Yeah.
So the basic plot, if you will, is in 1848, this enslaved couple, William and Ellen Craft, they escape slavery in Macon, Georgia, And they do this using an ingenious disguise. So Ellen is the daughter of an enslaved woman named Maria and her first enslaver. Mm-hmm. And from him, she's inherited a very light complexion, and she uses this mm-hmm. to her advantage. So she uses this to pass mm-hmm. as a rich, white, male enslaver mm-hmm. while William plays the part of her slave. Mm-hmm. So from Macon, Georgia, they go all the way up to Philadelphia, and it's a journey that was supposed to take just a couple beats. They were supposed to go from Macon to Savannah by train, and then from Savannah to Charleston by steamer, and then another steamship to Philadelphia, but of course it doesn't go that easily.
Okay.
And I think the thing that's really remarkable is their disguise, but also the fact that they're not hiding. You know, they're not traveling at night and hiding by day. They are traveling out in the open road, mm-hmm. you know?
And you have these dramatic moments where they see people who might identify them, right?
Yes. Yes, from the very beginning, really. Mm-hmm. I mean, as soon as they get to the train station, that in itself is, you know, your heart thumping mm-hmm. is thumping as you're, for me, like when I imagine them going, moving through Macon. But then when they arrive at the train station and you think, okay, he's settled in his car, in the Negro car as it's called, and she's settled, she's bought her tickets and she's sitting down. And then from that first moment, they see the cabinet maker in the shop where William works. And he's got this, it turns out later that he had this strange hunch that something was off. And he's coming, and he's looking through the cars, and Ellen is like, oh my gosh, what's happening? And mm-hmm. William is crouched down, and you think, how are they going to get out of this? And that's just the beginning.
Yeah, that's so good. Can you talk about a bit about your research? Because I actually forgot, you're trained as a literary scholar.
Mm-hmm.
You are such a diligent researcher. I mean, it's sort of, it's extraordinary. And I'm interested in you talking about what that process was like for you. Were there surprises? Were there sort of moments of kismet? I mean, what was it?
Oh, yeah. I went full Hermione Granger. I mean, I love doing that kind of digging, you know? Completely nerd, and this got me into trouble when I actually had to write, but that's another story. But the research part of it for now, it felt like a mystery unfolding is what it felt like. Because, as I said, the crafts explain a lot in their narrative, but then there are things that they don't say. Mm-hmm. They don't, for example, reveal the names of their enslavers. There are other scholars who had discovered those names before, for which I was really grateful. But I felt like maybe we can learn more about them. Maybe we can learn more about their world. And so the other scholars had discovered James Smith, Ellen's mm-hmm. first enslaver and father. But William's enslaver was kind of a mystery.
Mm.
He names this enslaver as Kraft, Mr. Kraft.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought, well, maybe there's a Mr. Kraft that we can find.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought, well, what do we know about this Mr. Kraft? Well, this Mr. Kraft has money troubles. And when people in power have money troubles, they're usually documented.
Yeah.
And when they have mortgages and when they have deeds they're working through, they're usually documented. And I thought, well, maybe I can find this person.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe there's some guy who has financial troubles and it's in the newspaper. So this is where, like, the internet search was really, I mean, the online newspaper search, this is stuff that,
so good.
I mean, a generation ago you couldn't have done.
Yeah.
But I remember sitting in front of the computer in my own kitchen, you know, and looking at these online newspapers and just typing in Kraft and thinking, what Kraft is in trouble? And there was a man named Hugh Kraft who was in trouble. And I thought, is this our guy?
Mm-hmm.
And it turned out, I mean, through a lot more research, but that it was.
Wow.
So that was the beginning. And it was like, once I found him, it was really kind of like, I felt like, you know, I was tapping on like a wall of a house,
mm-hmm.
And following the path, this map that other scholars had before. And then when I found that, I kind of felt like my hand, you know, it's like in a movie
yeah.
where your hand like just pierces through the wall, and you're like, wait a second, there's something on the other side.
Yeah.
And the more I reached and the more I dug, and then the Hermione Granger in me was like super excited. I found that there was like a whole, first I thought it was a room, and then it turned out to be like a building, and then a whole world on the other side of that wall.
Yeah.
And then I couldn't stop.
Maybe can you talk about the kinds of documents that you, like what were the, what sorts of things were the, like sort of the keys? I mean, you talk about the newspapers, which are just, for me, it's just, it's such a bonanza, right? Mm-hmm. These digitized newspapers. But you were in lots of different types of documents. Yeah.
So, I mean, it really depends on the kind. So mm-hmm. the newspapers definitely, they give sort of a lot of the really public information. Some of the other archival finds I found were the deeds and the mortgages.
Mm-hmm.
And there was one day when I was in the Bibb County Courthouse, mm-hmm. and somebody let me in upstairs. and I thought, wow, I could just like stay here forever and nobody would even know. And I can get my hands on all these. It was pretty incredible because, you know, you go into the archives, like the American Antiquarian Society,
right,
places like that, and like they've got their cradles, they're watching you like a hawk.
Right.
You got to put your gloves on.
Yep.
No, mm-hmm. you can't touch anything.
You can't touch anything.
So here I was like, I can open these books and I can do what I want with them. And on this day, I found the deed by which Ellen Craft was legally gifted by her father enslaver to her own half sister, who became her mistress.
Yeah.
And that was a, I mean, it was a moment that just made me sit down in the archives, you know. In this document, James Smith says, you know, to my daughter Eliza, he says that he's giving this gift out of the love he bears for his daughter. And the gift that he's giving is another child.
Mm.
It just... It was astonishing to see that on the page.
Mm-hmm.
You know the story, but then to see that script and to see the words by which this will is becoming an action.
Yeah.
And not only for Ellen, but for all of her posterity.
Mm-hmm.
He says he gives not only Ellen, but her increase, meaning her children and her children's children and their children, as long as it will go, and he gives them all away
mm-hmm.
with a stroke of a pen.
Mm. I find that so, the way that you talk and the way that you write about the subjects to be so moving and profound because they are fully human in all of their complexity. And I wanted actually to, maybe if we could talk about craft, or
mm-hmm.
sort of crafting the crafts, as it were, related to that, because, you know, we have a very sort of, we have these sort of very particular kinds of formal training, as, you know, and scholars, and then for those of us who love narrative, in many ways you have to undo some aspects of that training to tell a good story. And
Such,
right? And it's such an incredibly wrought story at the level of form and you know, to register both emotionally and also to get all of the details right. Can you talk about how you put the story part together, right?
Yeah, that was a completely different process.
Yeah.
And in some ways, I had to tell my inner Hermione Granger to, like, sit down for a moment because she just wanted to stuff everything. My writing partner and I talk about this as, mm-hmm. like, you know, like I just picture like stuffing a sausage, right? Just like, oh, I found this and I found that. You just like everything going. You want people to know, right?
All
this fascinating stuff, but they don't need to know all that stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And when I with the first draft that I wrote, my wonderful editor Don Davis, you know, I thought normally when I write something, I think, you know, this is bad, this is not working, or whatever. And this one, I thought I had done a pretty good job. And I sent it to Don, and I expected to hear, you know, pretty soon, yes, you're on your way, like, keep running with this. And what I had done was I started with all that backstory. So what I started with, what was really one of the key moments, like the heart of the book, of the Crafts narrative, which is the moment at which William Craft loses his sister.
Mm-hmm.
So this is a heart-wrenching moment when William having been mortgaged by Mr. Kraft, Mr. Hugh Kraft, and Mr. Hugh Kraft having lost the terms of that mortgage, William and his sister are auctioned. And I started with that moment, the emotional, in many ways, the emotional core of the story. And then I built around that, and I probably buried all of that with way too much detail about Kraft and about the, you know, the life in that time and what the auctions were. Anyway, I had a pretty unwieldy story that started with the past. And what Don told me, I got back like a 6-page letter that started with, "You've clearly done a staggering amount of research." Staggering. I could just see her stumbling under all the stuff I had buried her under. And she said, "You've written, you've created a scholarly tomb." But nobody's.
I can hear her saying that.
But nobody's going to want to read this the way it is.
Yeah.
Nobody's going to want to read all backstory. And basically, you're going to have to start over. And she said, "You're going to have to start over as you did, you know, when you were telling me about the story, which is the moment where the escape begins." So the moment where the story, the action of the story begins now is at 4 a.m. in this cabin behind the enslaver's mansion in Macon, Georgia, as William and Ellen Kraft are putting together the parts of their costume, and they're just ahead, right? The daylight's going to come in a couple hours, and they're getting ready to leave. She said, "You need to start there." I thought, well, if I start there, then how do I do all that back stuff before? And she said, "You're going to have to fit it in." And I was overwhelmed, Imani. I didn't know how I was going to do that.
Right. But you did.
I did. It made me think of, actually, so when I was completely upside down, not knowing how I was going to write the story, I started trying to draw from everything I did know and everything I had learned and everything I had tried creatively, because obviously the historical digging part was, you know, that needed to take a back seat. And I have a background as a musician.
Yes.
And I remembered when I was in middle school, there was a piece that I really wanted to play. It was Chopin's Fantasy Impromptu. And it has like a, it's super fast, you know? I mean, and what gives it its incredible speed and its feeling of almost like out of control speed is that there are two rhythms going on, in the right hand and the left hand. So in the right hand, you have triplets. In the left hand, you have triplets. So you have bump, 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 bump. And on your right hand, you have 16th notes. So you have ba 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 ba. The problem is that those hands have to be played together. So I didn't know how to do that. And I really wanted to play this piece. And my teacher said, "If you want to learn this, by next week, you have to do it." So I thought, all right, how do I do that? Bum, 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 bum. And you have to find the moments where those, they converge, right?
Yeah.
So. And I found it. It took a while, but I found it.
Yeah.
And I realized it's the same thing. You have, you've got the story of the past, the triplets, and you've got the story of the present.
Yeah.
The 16th notes. And they have to, you have to find the moments of convergence, and that's how you find the beats.
Yeah.
And that's how you structure it forward.
Brilliant. You see? And you do that also with history, right? So that it's their story, but you situate them in this really interesting and complex historical moment, right? They're abolitionists, right? And they're in this network. Can you talk a little bit about
that? Yeah, I mean, that's the thing that's amazing about them. I mean, there's so many things that are amazing about them. But, you know, they could... Their original plan, right, was to go from Macon to Philadelphia to Canada.
Right.
And they could have changed their names and just disappeared and started their family, started a whole new life. But that's not what they do, right? As soon as they get to Philadelphia, here, Well, here they're not safe.
Right.
So mm-hmm. they have to go underground for a bit. But then this amazing man comes along, William Wells Brown. Mm. I named my plant after him. You know that.
Yes.
So
thriving plant.
He is my only plant that thrives. So I have to confess, I don't have a green thumb, and my William and Ellen's have not done so well. But this plant, I mean, this says it all about him. It's a Christmas cactus, but he blooms wherever whenever he wants, turns this like bright fuchsia. And that's what he's like. I mean, just like he was known kind of as a showman. He, in his time, he was as well known as Douglas.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. But people don't remember him as well now.
Yeah.
Anyway, he heard about this incredible couple, and he knew right away they've got a story,
mm-hmm.
and this is a story that's going to move people, and they've got to tell their story. And so he asks them, and at that point, they could have said no, right? They could have said, we're going to Canada,
mm-hmm.
but they escaped. They accomplished this huge feat, not only for themselves, but for their people,
mm-hmm.
their loved ones, and all those left behind. And so they didn't change their names. They didn't go disappear. They didn't go to Canada. Instead, they traveled all over New England. You know, I mean, just think about it. It was just weeks after they had made this incredible journey. And they're traveling like every day,
yeah.
speaking like every couple of days in a row. It's like a whirlwind tour, and that puts targets on their back.
Yeah. Yeah. And I'm wondering about how you understand this, your book, in relation to their narrative.
Mm.
Because you have, you know, you're actually so, the word is not gracious, but you talk about how profound that is, and it is, but it's a different kind of work, and I think it serves a different function, but can you share what that is for you?
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, the narrative is powerful, as I mm-hmm. said. Like, I had that kind of seismic experience reading it, and I hope that everybody will pick up that narrative. You can find it easily on Hathi Trust or just Google Books or whatever. It's accessible. So the story, in a way, has, if we're going to continue this musical metaphor, has like three movements or three acts. So the first is the craft's escape from the South. And then there's sort of a middle section or a second movement where they're traveling across the Northeast and they're on the lecture circuit. And then the Fugitive Slave Act passes.
Mm-hmm.
Their lives are imperiled, really hugely imperiled. They become a test case
mm-hmm.
for the whole nation. And then they have to escape America again. So, and then there's a third act when they go abroad.
Mm-hmm.
So the crafts are very detailed about the first act. That's where most of their energy lies.
Right.
The second and the third are barely there.
Right.
So one big thing that I do is to open up those second and third acts.
Yeah. Why do you think it is that the 19th century seems to be so important for us right now? Like this, you know, I'm just thinking about, you know, yours is the most recent, I think, in a series of incredibly important books that take us back to the 19th century that I think part of what they do is actually help us understand where we are. But I don't know, what are your...
Yeah, I mean, I was thinking about this as I was traveling,
mm-hmm.
as I was doing the research travels and moving through space and navigating. I am directionally challenged, but I'm again my inner like researcher. I can memorize the heck out of a map,
mm-hmm.
so I would get these 19th century maps and figure out where everything is, and I would find, like, let's say if I was in Savannah or if I was in Philadelphia, that I could find my way around by this map.
Yeah.
And as I traveled along these places and I sailed along the Potomac and I looked at Mount Vernon passing by the same way that the crafts might have seen it passing by, as I traveled in Richmond over the waters and I saw the remains of this old 19th century train track,
mm-hmm.
that past is in our present. It's in the landscape, it's in the architecture,
yes.
it's in us. And I think we feel that presence when we go back to the stories. And I think the stories also I hope that this will give a way of understanding our present in a new way. There are a lot of strange parallels. It's not just the landscape that carries the past in it.
Yeah, but I love that you said the architect, because in some ways it's sort of how the spaces we occupy were built that are still present.
Yes.
Right? As much, yeah. Of the places you traveled, were there any that were particularly, I guess it's sort of a different question, not so much a research question, but a kind of more the sort of emotional register of doing this kind of work that stayed with you in terms of the geographies, places you went that you felt, I don't know, the power of the story or the difficulty or the pain? Obviously, this is a kind of biased question because of my interest in the places you traveled, but yeah.
So many. I mean, like we were talking before about Savannah.
Savannah,
that's one place where, you know, the streets are very much the same. You go to Johnson Square. I found out that that's where the crafts, when they're traveling to Savannah, there's a part in the narrative where they describe stopping over someplace for tea, and I thought, that's weird. You stop for tea along this journey? And it turns out, actually, that there are old travel guides from the 19th century where you can actually see all the stop changes and things like that, and you can map where people go. And I found out that there is this line, and you do have to stop. And I found out from newspapers that they stopped in Johnson Square, and they stopped at the Pulaski House. And that was pretty amazing because to know geographically that that's right, I mean, that's like the central axis of the slave trade.
Yeah.
And I went on this really interesting tour. It's called Journey by Faith. Mm-hmm. And the tour guide was talking about how, so we're in Johnson Square. I'm standing right where the crafts had once passed through. And she says, look at these trees in the square. If you go anywhere else in Savannah, there's Spanish moss on all the trees.
Oh, that's right, yeah.
But in this square, the moss won't grow. And it's said that the moss won't grow there because of the pain that square had seen. So that square had seen a lot. That square had seen, you know, fetting of the Declaration of Independence, you know, all these freedom movements in our country. But it had also seen sales of human beings, of people. Mm. One of the largest sales, known as the Weeping Time, was supposed to take place in Johnson Square, but it grew so big that they had to move it to a racetrack. Mm. But that's the history of that square. And, you know, scientists may say this moss won't grow for whatever reason, but I think there's another truth to that that the trees tell.
Well, I think that is actually sort of, it's profound because it says something about what the uses of history are, right? Because there's a piece of history, right, that would be, you know, science of trees and what happened, but then there's also the stories that people tell to make sense of the places they occupy. That too is a form of history making, right? And that, so that you had, that you found those stories and that becomes part of your interpretation, I think is really profound.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Well, I really wanted to try to use all the senses, you know? I mean, that first reading for me was such a kind of a sensual experience, hearing, feeling like I was hearing the words in my ear. And I wanted the reader to have that same access to taste and smell and texture. I was thinking about this while watching Pinocchio and the making of Pinocchio. The name of the document, not the documentary, the Guillermo del Toro.
Right. Okay. Mm-hmm.
And he's speaking about how he was creating this animation. And I love it because he's like going, you know, he went full Hermione Granger. He's like studying the way the dust settles on the books and all the teeniest, tiniest things. And the way he puts it is that by animating the ordinary, you achieve the extraordinary.
Oh, it's gorgeous.
And what I wanted to do was to animate the ordinary to evoke the extraordinary, because it's when we try to enter that world and try to be there besides mm-hmm. William and Ellen Craft, it's when we can see the ordinary details of the things that they're, you know, smelling and touching and having access to, those sensations.
Yes.
The extraordinary nature of their achievement comes into relief.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. One of the things that I learned early on that I also think is really impressive and also hard is that you actually have relationships with descendants of the Crafts,
mm-hmm.
which is hard to do historically for a range of reasons, because oftentimes people are invested in you telling stories in particular ways, but it's wonderful if you can do it because you get another dimension of their lives, right? How did that come about?
I feel incredibly grateful mm-hmm. to have connected with the descendants of William and Ellen Craft the way I have. And I mean, they are the stewards of this history.
Mm-hmm.
They have kept and preserved and told and loved and passed on this history over so many generations. I mean, I think often I get this question, like, how has the story faded away? But it hasn't, and it's remained alive, and it's remained alive out of their generosity mm. and their preservation, and their loving the papers enough to entrust them publicly.
Yeah.
So there's a whole collection at the Avery Research Center
yes.
where you can look at the Crafts photo albums and like an actual box that William made and, you know, locket with his image, all kinds of things.
Mm-hmm.
And I actually met they have many descendants,
yes.
and these descendants live all over the country mm-hmm. and all over the world,
yeah.
And you know, are teachers and
they're so accomplished, right?
Yeah, incredible thing, like yeah. filmmakers yeah. and mm-hmm. you know, educators and activists, and one of the great great granddaughters, Ms. Peggy Trotter Demon mm-hmm. Priestley, has become a dear friend,
yeah.
and I met her through the filmmaker Charles Burnett.
Oh wow.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, if you all have questions, start to get them ready. I'm going to ask this last question before turning it over to you all. So one of the things that I am so moved by is how we have sort of walked these similar paths, even though we haven't been in touch for many of the past, I won't say how many years. And I'm wondering, is this sort of a... I do wonder how much sort of spending time in Massachusetts as a child, as a deeply historical space, actually, you think, has it attuned you to history? I mean, just when you talk about the artifacts in the Avery Institute, I'm like, oh, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I mean, I just sort of this kind of visceral response to being in those space. And I just wonder how much it's being in a historically rich place or falling in love with books and documents early on, or are there pieces of your early experience that feel as though they shaped or prepared you for this type of work in particular?
You know, I think I would point to the school that we went to together.
Yeah.
That was a really special place
yeah.
where we used to play in the monkey bars or whatever it was,
yeah.
but it's the King Open School, yeah. which is named for the Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King Jr.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And, you know, when reading about all these, you know, arguments over how history is supposed to be taught and what kind of history, and, you know, there's so much ownership over different kinds of history, I didn't grow up with that.
Yeah.
We went to a school where we weren't taught these stories from textbooks. So history was sung, it was
yes.
mm-hmm. told, it was played, it was mm-hmm. visual.
Mm-hmm.
I remember I had teachers in the fourth and fifth grade, sixth grade, who they would just paper these big sliding doors that we had, paper them with images. So you would see history, you would feel history, and you would get what is now called Black history.
Right.
But it was history.
It was history.
It was just
yeah.
American history.
Mm-hmm.
And I was proud of my American history.
Yeah.
And a lot of, I think, how I approach history now really comes from that education.
That's beautiful. Wonderful. Questions in the audience?
Thank you. This is very interesting. But a quick question being, how did you tumble on their story? I can understand why you would want to write it, but... how did you happen to come across it?
Well, I was very lucky that it was assigned to me. So thank goodness for teachers who put together great curriculum. But I was taking I was in graduate school, and I was in Robert O'Mealy's seminar. Actually, we were talking a lot about music, and he so I owe a lot to him. Mm-hmm. But he assigned this narrative in a class on the literature of passing. And he also, I have to thank him because, you know, I knew when I was in graduate school that I didn't want to write as an academic. Mm. That's not how I wanted to tell stories. Yeah. And I asked him, like, how did you do it, like, with jazz? Because he was saying that he had this long desire to write about music, write about jazz, and he went to, like, an amazing writer who he admired, and he said, how did you do it? And this teacher essentially said, you know that Nike slogan? Just do it.
Love it. Oh, I love it. It's so nice to be here as someone who was in graduate school with Ilyan many, many years ago. And I'm so proud to see what you have been able to just do. It's really, really moving.
Oh, thank you.
So my question is back to the question of craft, as in the craft of writing, which I think you spoke about so incredibly beautifully. And the musical analogy, I think, was especially moving. But as a writer myself, someone who's struggling with how do you pull together these stories, I'm curious if you would speak a little bit more about working with the craft narrative and trying to figure out where you step away from it, where you put context in, where you have the questions, how you weave it together, you spoke already. My question before coming in was, you know, how did you move from the craft narrative to your own? But I wanted to hear more about that process. Mm.
Yeah, well, I think it helped to have that one terrible, like, you know, stuffed sausage of a draft, because then I at least had all the stuff written out, right? And normally, when we were in graduate school, everyone said, you can't outline everything. At some point, you have to let go, and you have to improvise. And it was really like cooking. People would tell me, you have to feel it, you know, just add a little bit of here. I couldn't do that. I just want a recipe. I didn't want to, just tell me how to do it, and I'll do it. But this book just turned everything upside down. So once I had sort of written everything out, I kind of had to forget about it and really think about it again from the point of view of the action. And really, I tried to think more cinematically. Because the thing is, you have all these things crowding your mind, like you can go on so many detours, but in film, you're moving in time and you're also moving with a visual eye. So that's really how I tried to see it unfolding. And then I tried to move in the details really when the reader needs that information and not before. And I think that's a big difference with the academic writing, where you kind of have to explain everything first. This is it, actually, as my previous editor said, he called it a slow release. So that you're slowly releasing the information on a need-to-know basis. And in fact, sometimes you're withholding it.
Yeah. Well, since we're here in Philadelphia, and it sounds like Philadelphia plays a prominent place in the story, I wonder if you could talk a little bit more about that, about the other characters in Philadelphia that impacted the story without giving away anything you think we should have to read and not hear about tonight.
Yes, Philadelphia was such an interesting place in 1848 when the crafts were coming through. I always thought about, you know, you think about Philadelphia with Independence Hall and Liberty, and you think that it's, I thought, you know, you cross that Mason-Dixon line, you're in Philadelphia, and then you're done, right? But Philadelphia was a very complicated city at that time. There were lots of immigrants coming through. There were race riots. There was a lot of tension, a lot of racial tension going on. And in fact, the whole abolitionist movement was very much in flux at that time due to all the chaos of the preceding years. And whereas a couple of years ago, there was Robert Purvis and Harriet Purvis, who were kind of the heads of the Vigilance Committee, and they're the ones who would have taken on the crafts from the moment of their arrival, the organization had kind of lost its footing at that time. The Purvises had actually moved out of the city to Byberry. But luckily you have other people coming in, and the big person who's rising up at this point is William Still. And he wrote an incredible book. So he kept a book of secret records, and he ended up publishing it later. And that's where you get the first, one of the earliest sort of histories of the crafts in the 1870s. I mean, I could go on and on about him, and Wifflin Mistar Gibbs also is one of the other abolitionists who first arrive on the scene when they come. You know, it's with every character who came into the story, I felt like I just wanted to go right off with them for a really long time. So going back to that question about how do you control that balance between action or narrative and information, it's hard. But I tried as much as possible to look at each of these characters and to animate them even for just a moment. And I think actually one of the things that I love most about the jacket design for this book is, you know, what I'll do is I will undress the book because it's wearing this jacket. But if you take off this beautiful teal green jacket with master and slave, Ellen and William, husband and wife, on the cover, then you see that the book is actually in black and white. Mm-hmm. And when you open that book, you'll see all these people. These are the people in their world. And you can see, let's see, where's William? William Still is one of them. Robert Purvis, who I mentioned, is here. Mifflin Wistar Gibbs is here. So we tend to think of heroes as existing in isolation, but they're part of a whole world. And these are all heroes who participated in their world and in their action. And I wanted to honor them.
Hi, my name's Ken. For the past 3 years, I've been following the Underground Railroad, tracing Harriet Tubman's footsteps from Maryland to Canada. And one of the things I learned is freedom is not free. How did the crafts pay for their journey?
Oh, wow. Well, they didn't pay for it with their lives, thankfully. But I'm sure there was a huge emotional toll, especially for leaving their loved ones behind. I mean, that has to have been a central payment. And in fact, it's kind of a ransom. This is what one of the ways in which enslavers impose their control is that they held hostage the loved ones who are left behind. And that's especially apparent in Ellen's case. William had lost many of his family members, and his parents were not in Macon anymore by the time, by 1848. But Ellen's mother, Maria, was. And she was still enslaved by Ellen's biological father and first enslaver. And she was still enslaved by his wife. And it's actually on account of this wife that Ellen and her mother were separated, because Ellen bore such a strong physical resemblance to her father that his legal wife couldn't stand the sight of her. And at the soonest opportunity, when her own daughter was getting married, she gave Ellen away as a gift. And then she held on to Maria. And she held on to her not only over the years, but over the decades. There are records that show letters that describe how activists are trying to buy Maria's freedom over the years. And over all these years, even after James Smith, Ellen's father enslaver, dies, this woman will not relinquish her hold on Ellen Craft. But Ellen does win the day in the end.
I just wanted to say that I was able to get hold of an advanced copy of your book. I work in a bookstore. And I was so thrilled to see it that I just grabbed it right off the table. I was familiar with the craft story up to a point, but not the incredible details their epic journey and everything that you poured into this wonderful book. It was just fabulous, and I want to thank you so much for bringing their story out into the open, again, where it really needs to be.
Thank you. Thank you.
It means so much. It's and I hope your book will just go everywhere. It deserves to. It is wonderful.
Thank you.
I was curious when you mentioned earlier a little bit about like the breaking of the book into three parts, or their narrative into three parts, mm-hmm. with a third being of their, I think, of when they went to Europe or away from America.
Yes.
I assume Europe, and I know of a lot of other activists at around the same time, like Frederick Douglass, who also ran away, but where they escaped to Europe to escape the Fugitive Slave Act. And I was curious about, you said that there wasn't as much information about them, or it was something that wasn't as easy to find, or that they necessarily didn't tell as much about their time in Europe, about when they were away from America. And I was curious if there was anything, if there was any like anything more or anything you would like to share.
No, that's a great question. I'm really glad we get to talk about their time in the UK. That's something we haven't touched on, and. So, yes, they flee. They have to flee America, and they get to England. And you know what? It just so happens that guess who's on the circuit telling his story and, you know, rousing audiences? It's William Wells Brown. So they show up, and they get in touch with him right away, or he gets in touch with them, and he says, "You want to take this show on the road?" And they say yes. So that's the start of a whole nother abolitionist lecture circuit, travel, storytelling, media extravaganza. They travel all over the UK. They travel, and not only do they tell their story, but they have a panorama, which is like a giant painting. If you imagine a painting stretching all the way over from here to there, you know, all the way across the stage, lights are low, and William Wells Brown is in the front here, and he's lighting up different parts of this picture and taking you through it, and the crafts are there too, and they're coming out at these dramatic moments. It's a whole other part of the story, and really exciting.
I was wondering, when former slaves were on these tours, were they compensated for their time? And or in some ways, and is that how the crafts earn their money? Because you also talked about, you know, how they made this choice, but I wonder, I sort of liken it in some way to maybe people who flee a country and come here. There's still a period of time where they have to learn to navigate, and whether anybody is actually showing them the way or just taking advantage.
No, that's a very good question. So yes, they did raise funds. Some, like William Wells Brown and Frederick Douglass, they might have a sort of an official relationship with one of the major, like the Pennsylvania Abolitionist Society, for example. Like they might kind of engage them to go for several months, or and they'd get a salary that way. Oftentimes, actually, the black lecturers were not paid, compensated as much as the white ones. So there were inequities there, but there was pay. They didn't usually have sort of ticketed performances. They were usually free, but they would start circulating the coffers and pass that around at the end. But in fact, the crafts were so successful with William Wells Brown that by the end of their lecture tour in New England, they were actually charging admission, which was unusual.
Good evening, ladies. I'm reading both of your books at the same time. And I realized that you guys did extensive research. Now, I don't know if you had any preconceived ideas about the South, but as you finished your research and your book, how do you see the South then and today on an emotional level? Mm.
I mean, I'll start, but then you, okay. I mean, I think you have so much to say on this, Imani. I feel like our books kind of talk to each other in a way.
They do.
Mm-hmm. I mean, I think there's a tendency to demonize the South and look at the history and say, all right, they were slavers. You know, this was, you know, they were the bad guys, right? Mm-hmm. But in fact, there was slavery all over our nation. And when you had people like the Crafts emancipating themselves and going to the North, it wasn't like they were all of a sudden free. The laws of the nation still held them in bondage. Mm-hmm. And the whole of the United States is accountable. And so I think it's tempting to say, oh, in the North or in Philadelphia and Boston, wherever, you know, we weren't like that, and to kind of other the South. But I think stories like the Crafts show the ways in which we have always been one nation.
Mm-hmm. I think that's absolutely true. One of the things we were talking about earlier that is what I immediately think of in response to your question is, you know, my experience of sort of feeling like a Southerner, born in the South and a Southerner and in exile, and my family is there in some ways feels akin to first and second generation immigrant experiences in mm-hmm. the sense that there's this sense of half of myself always being this other place, and because my family's there, because the culture is there and all that. And so, but there's also the reality that when you're not present, you miss a great deal. Right. And so and that is a source of grief, but it's also in the process of writing for me is a source of having to be reflective about what I didn't know. I would say the biggest thing is for me, though, is with respect to what you asked, is an awareness of South's plural. Right. So that Alabama is being born in Alabama. Like there's a sense that for me, South always meant deep South until I was, you know, having encounters to learning about slavery in Maryland, which I had lived in before, but had never, ever thought of Maryland as the South, the sort of Mason-Dixon. I had a whole piece that actually wound up, that I had a very similar experience to yours, where I had all of this stuff that had to be taken out, but was about the creation of the Mason-Dixon line, like with all of these details.
I want those details.
Okay. It's a behemoth. It's a mess, but yeah.
Yeah, I hope you'll write it. Right, yeah.
But that's actually, sorry, and there's other questions. I was going to ask, are you doing stuff with the pieces that you didn't wind up putting in the book? But.
Well, that might be why I joined Instagram today, because I feel like there's so
Come
many
on over
pictures,
to the dark side,
you
yes.
know? Yeah.
Right. Yes. Yes.
There's so many pictures. I mean, there's this printed matter, and there's a story told, but then there are all these images and all these things that you can connect to, mm-hmm. all these sources that are available online that I feel like they just need to be out there.
Yeah, mm-hmm. absolutely.
Hi, thanks for sharing this process and about writing this story. So I'm curious to know the timing. How much time did you research before? And then once you start writing, did you kept coming up with new research and integrating it, or it was just two separate processes?
The left hand and the right hand again. Some of it was simultaneous. I mean, I was researching up until really very, very late. I think that my editor was like in a little bit of a, oh, you're going back? Do you know what time it is? So some of this, you know, I just like had an appetite for that, so I couldn't stop. But what happened, so each chapter, I would sort of like in the Philadelphia chapter, I just went down a deep, dark Philadelphia hole. And then when I was in Boston, you know, it was like all Boston. But the actual writing of it, so again, I'm usually an outliner. I'm usually a recipe follower. But because I threw all that out, I had this really strange writing process for this book. I don't think we've talked about this. But I sat down at the keyboard and I decided, all right, I'm going to like give myself this time to read all this stuff, and I'm going to sit down. I'm not going to look at it. So I sat down and I just closed my eyes and I played. This is a weird thing because I'm not even a poetry person, but I wrote in verse. So the entire book, I actually wrote one verse at a time. So I'd write, I saved it as a fast through. So it's like a playthrough, like when you're first reading music and you're just kind of like stumbling through it. So I did that. And then usually there was some breath in there, some movement that was right. And then I would unhitch each of the verse lines, turn it into paragraphs, and start playing around and filling it in. And then sometimes I found that I would stuff so many things in there that I have to unlock it all and go back to verse again. But it was this, it was, that's how I wrote this book. It was painstaking with all the locking and unlocking, and then footnotes is a whole nother awful thing.
It's the worst.
Yeah. I mean, because when you're writing in an organized way and you're doing it like, you know, one little recipe line at a time, you put that footnote right in there and you know exactly where it is. But if you play everything through, then you have to go and figure out where like all it came from, and that's a, yeah.
Can you talk about the decision that the crafts made, how, if you know, how they were so compelled to take this enormous risk? Mm. Like, where did that come from?
That is a huge question, and I'm not just saying that to ask you to read the book, but that's really kind of what unfolds over the whole first movement. It's not the kind of thing I can explain in a sentence, but I will say that from the first page of their narrative, what they make really clear is that they want to have freeborn children, that they had both been so deeply traumatized by their own experiences as children. In fact, Ellen doesn't want to get married for a while because she just cannot bear the thought of going through that herself as a mother, what she experienced as a child. Mm. And so they say, right from that first paragraph, we wanted to escape because we couldn't bear the thought of somebody, you know, this brute reaching into the cradle that we had made for our child and taking that child away. Another thing, though, that they cite is the Declaration of Independence. They quote those lines in the preface, and they say, they quote the line, "We hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal, that they are endowed by their Creator with certain unalienable rights, that among these are life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness." They heard these words in Macon, and they knew that these words were for them, too.
Mm. Oh, on that note, thank you so much. Everybody, come upstairs and buy the book.
Thank you.
So beautiful.
Thank you for listening to this podcast from the Free Library of Great Conversations. If you live in Philadelphia or are planning a visit and would like to attend an author event, information on the series is available at freelibrary.org/authorevents.